This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The world's largest democracy, India, is embroiled in a new political battle, maybe not so new, this time over cows. Hindus, particularly upper caste Hindus, consider cows too sacred to eat. However, lower caste Hindus, also known as Dalits, as well as Indian Christians and Muslims, have consumed beef as part of their diet for centuries. Now, after the election of Prime Minister Narendra Modi from the right-wing Hindu Fundamentalist Party, or BJP, the issue of cow consumption has become hugely politicized. Beef bans have cropped up all over India, and last year there was a high-profile killing of a 52-year-old Muslim man for allegedly eating beef. More recently, some young Dalit men were brutally beaten up by a so-called cow protection group. Their beating, captured on video, has sparked massive Dalit protests all over India. Complicating matters is the fact that under Modi, India has increased its beef exports worldwide to become one of the world's largest beef producers. My guest is Tenmori Soundararajan. She's a Dalit American trans media artist and activist, and she closely follows these issues. Welcome to the program, Tenmori.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, let's talk about the most recent beating of these Dalit, young Dalit men. They were basically caught skinning a dead cow. And for our TV audience, we're going to show you the video. Do be warned, however, it is a very disturbing video. So either turn off the TV version or look away as we're playing this. But as this is happening, as we're showing this to our TV audience, can you explain the context of this beating? How is it that this even came about? How is it that this is considered something that this group of so-called cow protection vigilantes justifies?
Well, I think, you know, the rise of the cow protection vigilantes is really an example of the height of hypocrisy that exists within caste apartheid in India. And what you have is this idea that the cow represents the mother and is the holy symbol for Hindus, but more specifically for fundamentalist Hindus or those who are followers of Hindutva. They've been using this policy of the sacredness of the cow to go after the most vulnerable within society. And in this case, it means Dalits and it means Muslims. And the irony is that when you look at the larger cow industry or the bovine industry in India, 4 out of the 6 major exporters of cow are actually Hindus. So if these cow protection outfits were really concerned about the treatment of animals, the slaughter of animals, they would go after these Hindu exporters of beef that are actually making millions and millions of dollars off of the slaughter of cows. Unfortunately, what they're doing instead is going after the most vulnerable, which are Dalits and Muslims, who are actually not even slaughtering the cow. What happens is when a cow is abandoned, you know, for whatever reason, because it has died, the life has, you know, gone forward, our communities are forced through caste apartheid system to then process the individual carcasses. And that means taking the cow, skinning it, giving the bones to the people that process the bones, making materials out of it, and then also whatever meat is left out of it, our communities eat that. And for these tasks, we have been punished for centuries for being polluting to other people. So it's a very kind of like cyclical hypocrisy, because they're going after the most vulnerable, who are really forced to do this occupation because of the caste prescriptions in society, whereas the entire beef industry is actually to the benefit of many, many rich Hindus who they don't even touch at all with this violence. And so it's really kind of a cycle of hypocrisy that's only possible with caste apartheid.
Now, in terms of Muslims being targeted, this is, of course, in line with an Islamophobia in India that we've had for a while now, growing Islamophobia, also related to India's rivalry with Pakistan and this idea that Muslim Indians are traitors within the country, sympathetic to Pakistan, etc. And last year, the killing of this Muslim man that I mentioned, Muhammad Akhlaq, a 52-year-old man. Tell us a little bit about this story. I understand that he was accused of eating beef. It turned out he wasn't even eating beef. But even if he had been eating beef, why, I mean, he's a Muslim man, why should have that been considered a crime? And what does that represent about this this political chapter of India under Modi?
Well, I think that, what we're seeing that India under Modi has become a hotbed of ridiculous fundamentalism and has brought fear to any religion and practitioners of religions that are not Hindu. So that means if you're Muslim, if you're Christian, if you're Buddhist, if you're a cultural community like the Dalits, you're finding that all of our practices and traditions are coming under the crosshairs of this very empowered fundamentalist community, such that India has now become one of the largest fundamentalist countries in the world. And so a crime, a cultural crime under Hindutva could be something as simple as eating beef. And, in the case of the Muslim man that was lynched, who you just talked about, it was a very sad story because his family had been living side by side with with Hindus for many years. And there was a cry from the Hindu temple saying there was this family and they were eating beef. And so they came in, and the cry came from the temple, and then a mob descended on this family, pulled this man out, beat him, and lynched him for eating beef. And the funny thing is that when the police came, the police did not come to apprehend the people that murdered this man. They came first to test the meat to see whether or not it was in fact beef. And the irony is that a year later after this attack, it was very clear. There was no question as to who was responsible. There was no question to who were the perpetrators because it was seen in public. The police saw it. And now the families of the perpetrators, and the perpetrators are now currently in jail, are saying they've given the state an ultimatum saying, yes, maybe our boys did something wrong, but why are those initial perpetrators, the people eating beef, being absconding? And so they're asking for a response to further punish this family, which has lost their father, because the meat has tested positive for beef. And they said if they don't get a response in the next 20 days, and we're in that 20-day period, they're going to launch more violence.
So this story, even though the killing, the lynching of this Muslim man happened last year, the story continues and the family continues to basically be in the crosshairs of these vigilante groups.
Yes, and actually, this is the thing is that the vigilantism and the license for that vigilantism goes all the way up to the central government. Very easily, the Prime Minister Narendra Modi could have issued a statement at the beginning of his administration, because we saw these crimes starting to happen like within the first like 60 to 90 days of his administration. And now several years into his process, we're seeing that the climate of violence against anyone who is not Hindu is given so much license by all of the government entities that it is a very, very dangerous thing to now understand that India is the largest fundamentalist country in the world.
Now, Tenmori, what about the fact that Modi and even some upper caste, Hindus who hold political office are attempting to mollify the Dalit community, but of course not really address crimes against Muslims? I understand that Modi recently gave a speech where he actually addressed for the first time this cow protection vigilantism and said, "Don't shoot Dalits. If you want to shoot someone, shoot me." He was silent on the killings of Muslims. And so far, I understand at least four Muslims have been killed within this past year in the name of beef consumption. Modi simply blames state governments for them. So it looks like the BJP is attempting to create a divide between Dalits and Muslims. However, of course, I understand Dalits and Muslims are essentially both targeted groups, right?
Yeah, but I don't think that anyone is actually taking with any sort of genuine response his remarks as truth or accurate to his essentially his party's positions. Because the reality is that the speech that you talked about, where he made this public, like, you know, there's a hashtag that formed out of it called Hindutva Tamasha, which is kind of like, you know, the drama of Hindu fundamentalism. And, you know, in some ways, like, Modi was trying to play a good cop, saying, look, like, we really care about what's happening with Dalits. Like, please don't attack Dalits, attack me. And the irony was, is he made that statement in Hyderabad, where his very same administration targeted Dalit students in the University of Hyderabad who were fighting for their rights. And it was his administration, his minister, that targeted them as anti-national for their activism, which led to the untimely suicide of the Dalit activist Rohit Vemula. So I think the best response to him was, in fact, this the best response to their position was actually given by those students from the University of Hyderabad, where they basically publicly said, whatever you say, we don't believe you. Whatever you say, we know that you are lying. Whatever you say, we know that there has to be an alternative. And it's not you. And we don't take anything you say seriously because our brother has died in the very same city that you are now saying you are for Dalit rights.
Right. Now, Ken Mori, how have people on the ground responded? Let's talk about the mass protests that are happening on the ground. And also, are there, you know, is there growing unity between minority groups in India, between Dalits and Muslims? And even, you know, what about the Christian community?
So I think this is the thing that does not get covered a lot within the upper caste media within India, but the relationships and the solidarities between Dalit Muslims and Christian and Buddhist communities, as well as Sikh and Ravadasi communities, is very strong. And it has historically, we have had some very interesting collaborations in Tamil Nadu, in Gujarat, in Haryana, that show those relationships. And I think that what we're seeing is that Hindutva is unifying multiple cultural communities because we are all under attack. And so in this last year and a half alone, we've seen Christians who've been targeted for God Wapsi or forced conversion campaigns. We've seen Muslims similarly lynched and beaten. We've seen Dalits, like, you know, not only facing, you know, an extended level of atrocity, but we're also seeing like extended levels of sexual violence between Dalit, Muslim, and Christian communities. And, you know, with caste, you have caste in multiple religious communities as well. And I think it's the Dalits and all of these religious traditions that are also helping to kind of unify all of these platforms and frames.
In very recently, on August 3rd, the New York Times published an op-ed called Modi and India's Dalits. How much of an issue is this becoming for India internationally? It looks like even the Western media sort of looking on and seeing that this is becoming a growing problem for India's government, a government that Modi got elected, you know, with a platform of bringing economic prosperity to all Indians, and now the country is being consumed by the, you know, these issues that don't really have much to do with economic prosperity for all.
Well, I think this is why I wish that these same outlets had covered the resistance to Modi's candidacy when he was running for prime minister. Because the reality is you cannot de-link development from a party's like religious and cultural platforms. And, you know, the BJP can say all that they want that, you know, we want to bring India into the 21st century. We want to bring India into prosperity, but you cannot achieve that through cultural fascism, which is what this fundamentalist party has been known for.
Now, here in the United States, in addition to the media covering what's happening in India, you do have some elements of Hindu supremacy having
Absolutely.
infiltrated U.S. politics as well. And last time we had you on our program, it was to talk about a political battle in California, where this program is produced between this group called the Hindu American Foundation and activists like yourself over a curriculum for American students on the history of Hinduism. Hinduism. How has that battle played out? How is it related to what's happening inside India?
Well, I think you have to keep in mind that the ambition of Hindu fundamentalists in India is unrivaled, possibly only by ISIS.
And wow, I think really?
They have a very powerful vision for bringing Hindu fundamentalism to every country on the globe. They imagine themselves being able to have institutions in multiple countries. And in both London and in the United States, they have very strong arms of the RSS, which is like the cadre of, when you think about Hindu fundamentalism, they have multiple organizations that are part of their constellation of power, and they each do different sorts of things. So within India, you have something called the VHP and the RSS and the BJP. And the BJP is the political party, and the VHP and the RSS are kind of the cadre and political arms of those entities. So you see those same organizations having roots in the United States. The Hindu American Foundation is the soft face for these groups in the United States, but there is a VHP America in the United States. There's also the RSS of the USS, the USA, which is called the HSS. And, it can be confusing to think about all of these abbreviations, but I think the most important thing for people to know in the US is these groups are funding political action committees. So there's the Hindu American Political Action Committee. They're supporting candidates that are in congressional office that'll support their positions and their policies. So, for example, folks that were funded through the Hindu American Political Action Committee, as well as other kind of constellation PACs, were some of the people that helped to push congressmen who helped invite Modi to speak to Congress. And we have people who are directly funded by these groups that are on the Foreign Affairs Committee and are responsible for Indian affairs. So we're starting to see the impact of those groups also pushing serious economic and political policy at the state and at the federal level. And
The United States, just to remind our audience, we're talking about
here in the United States. So I think it's very dangerous for people to assume that fundamentalism is only something that we see coming out of Islam, and that really we must start looking at India as one of the largest fundamentalist countries in the world, and that we must be able to fight and articulate the need to build the fight for religious tolerance, the fight for human rights as part of our strategic agreements and alliances with U.S. entities and Indian entities.
Well, Tenmori, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and helping shed some light on these issues.
Sure,
good luck
absolutely.
To you.
Yes, and thank you for covering this. This is really an important ongoing story, and I feel like the audience should not feel intimidated to start to grapple with these issues, because we are looking at the country that is the world's, the second largest economic market in the world. And so the things that happen there are going to continue to impact our relationships here. And so we have to get informed. We have to have dialogue. And I appreciate Sonali, that you keep making that forum happen.
Thank you so much. Tenmori Soundararajan is my guest. She's a Dalit American transmedia artist and activist. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.